The show is live and local. It's your local performance connection, and on today's program, we'll be talking with NPR's Neil Conan, who is best known to our listeners as a reporter, of course, but he's also involved in a project which is being presented at the Dowden Fine Arts Center at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston tonight in collaboration with an actress and also the Ensemble Galilei, early music. Well, I know them best as an early music group that also involves some visual imagery, and we'll be hearing more about that later on because it's going to require their explanation better than mine. But it explores a number of challenging themes of our time. First up, though, is a little more straightforward, a conversation with the first violinist of the Tokyo String Quartet, who are performing at the Krannert Center in Urbana Saturday night at 7:30, along with pianist Alon Goldstein. There'll be a couple of string quartets and then a piano quintet on that program. It's live and local. Hope you'll stay with us. We just heard a portion of the third movement of the piano quintet of Johannes Brahms, his F minor piano quintet, and a performance from 1986 or 87 by the Tokyo String Quartet with pianist Barry Douglas. And the Tokyo Quartet will be performing that piece with a different pianist, Alon Goldstein, on Saturday, tomorrow night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. Their first violinist is Martin Beaver, and he's on the phone with me right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So the quartet was partly different at, well, it was about halfway different at the time of the recording, that recording we just heard almost 25 years ago. You were not among the members. How long have you been with the group?
I've been with the group since the summer of 2002, so this is my 10th season at the moment.
And what, the first violinist has changed a few times since I knew the quartet was around, and the cellist is different from that one as well. The first, second violinist and violist are the same, Kikue Ikeda on the second violin, and Kazuhide Isamura, the violist, and current cellist is Clive Greensmith. What's the process that was involved in your getting to be involved in the quartet? Is there an audition, or do they just say, hey, I heard this guy, he might work with us, or what happens?
Yes, I was recommended to the quartet, actually, by two people. One is Jennifer Taylor, who's the manager of the series at Music Toronto in Toronto. So she knew me quite well from Canada, as I'm Canadian. And the other person that recommended me was Pinkus Zukerman, who I'd played a lot with and who, of course, had recorded with the quartet and performed with them a lot over its history. So I guess with these two recommendations, they gave me a call and said, well, actually, it was more modern than that. Clive, our cellist, sent me an email saying, you know, we don't know each other, but we have friends in common, and you may have heard that we're looking for a new first violin. And would you like to come and read with us? And of course, I said, yes, indeed, I would love to read with you. So at the time, I was teaching in Baltimore at the Peabody Conservatory, and I took a train up to New York, and we met for a couple of days and read through some quartets. And after that, basically, they said, well, you seem to be the, a good fit with us, and would you like to join us? And, I said, yes, of course I would. So that's basically how it happened.
Wow, just like that.
Yes, indeed.
Do you have any idea?
I believe I was the last, obviously the last candidate that they had tried, so.
Well, that was going to be my question. If you knew that, were you the only one or were there others before?
I believe there were others. I don't know who they were, but I do know that that they did try some other candidates, and I can imagine it must have been a quite a complicated process.
Well, yeah, you know, I had a conversation with one of the music director candidates for one of the local orchestras here about what the various processes for a conductor to get a gig. And it's quite different from, I imagine quite different than for somebody in a string quartet. Were you active previously in string quartets or with a quartet?
Well, I had a quartet for a few years in Toronto, which was called the Toronto String Quartet. And it was, by very definition, a part-time string quartet. There were three friends of mine and myself who we really enjoyed playing together, but we all had our various other things we were doing. So we would get together twice a year at Music Toronto, where my friend Jennifer Taylor had recommended me for the job. We used to play concerts sort of twice a year and sometimes build a little mini tour around that, and it's something that we really loved. But in terms of this kind of intense full-time string quartet touring, I had not.
So does that make it a special challenge for you to then learn a lot of the repertoire that maybe you hadn't played, that at least half of your quartet anyway, I don't know how long Mr. Greensmith's been in the group, probably knows backwards and forwards?
Yes. I mean, it was indeed a challenge to get some of the repertoire up. I've been lucky in my life that I've been blessed with the ability to learn things quickly, but it has been a challenge. In terms of my colleagues knowing the pieces, yes, they have played a lot of these pieces many, many, many times, so they're very familiar with them. However, as you can imagine, when any change occurs in a quartet, when there's a new member, then of course the dynamics change, and any new member will bring a different musical outlook to the table, and things will inevitably evolve. So in a way, it was really useful in some cases when we didn't have so much time to prepare things. Then definitely we relied on the fact that there was more familiarity from some of our members. However, I would say that they were very open to new musical points of view, both from Clive and from myself. And so it's been a very interesting process for sure.
Let's hear a little bit of the piece. Well, let me back up and say what's actually going to be in your program, because besides the Brahms, which we have mentioned, you're also opening the program with the one of Mozart's string quartets, his G major quartet, Kirchhoff 387. And
yes.
Then you're doing this piece by Polish composer Karol Szymanowski, who was born 1882, the first of his quartets. And this is one I don't know at all, other than having just sampled a little bit ago, some of his second movement, which I found quite beautiful. How did you come to decide to be working on this quartet? I mean, of all the quartets you could decide to work on.
Well, to be quite honest, we had been looking for a piece to take, I would say, the position on a program of the piece before the intermission, you know, the second piece, which is often quite tricky to program because it's easy, or let's say relatively easy, to say, let's start with a Haydn, or let's start with a Mozart, or an early Beethoven, or, you know, something that'll be fresh and something that'll really get the concert going well. And in the middle of the program is always an awkward place, because you don't want to play something so big as to impinge on the larger work in the second half, yet you want something that will in a way contrast from the first piece as well as the second half in a nice way. And we had been aware that Szymanowski had written two quartets, and we said, well, why don't we read one and listen to one and see if it'll work. And we found this work to be really terrific. As you pointed out, the second movement is a beautiful movement. It's very atmospheric, and and quite lovely. There's lovely lines in it, and the beginning is quite romantic. I got to do a lot of slides, which the violinists out there will appreciate, I'm sure.
Well, we're going to hear a performance of the beginning of this slow movement of the first quartet of Szymanowski. This is a performance by the Schoenberg Quartet. Tokyo hasn't yet recorded it. May do someday.
You never know.
And you're hearing it on Live and Local in advance on Saturday of their concert at the Krannert Center in Urbana. That was a bit of the opening move of the second movement of the first string quartet by Karol Szymanowski, which will be the middle piece on the program by the Tokyo String Quartet tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. They're also performing music of Mozart and Brahms, the Brahms Piano Quintet with pianist Alon Goldstein. And my guest on this portion of Live and Local is first violinist Martin Beaver. I wanted to ask you about that designation, first violinist. Many people would assume, I think, a couple of things, that, oh, the first versus the second means the first guy is the better player, and they may well assume that first violinist is therefore the leader of a string quartet. But my understanding is that neither of those is necessarily true. Who's right here, the assumption or me?
Well, I can tell you that definitely in our quartet, I think I would say your assumption is more correct, that these ideas of a first violinist being better or in fact the leader are not necessarily the case. I'd say there are some quartets that do work that way, and they work extremely well. In our quartet, our philosophy certainly is that we are a leaderless quartet, or in fact, we have four leaders, and our roles definitely change as the bar goes by. it's an ever changing thing, and very often you will find that a first violinist has what you would consider the melody or the tune. But even at that particular point, chances are that somebody else may actually be leading the overall pacing, which is great, so that whoever has the melody can just concentrate on playing the melody.
You know, I've been curious about something, one of the dynamics of string quartets. Since we started by talking about bringing somebody new into the quartet, when, say, a first violinist leaves, why wouldn't the second violinist decide, oh, I think I'll play first violin now? Which I think, isn't that what happened with the Juilliard Quartet when Robert Mann left? I think their second violinist moved to first, and then they brought in a second, if I'm remembering.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I think it depends on the individual quartets and whether, in fact, a second violinist, in quotations, feels comfortable with assuming the role of the first violin. I mean, as you said, the second violinist is not necessarily any less of a player than the first violinist, but their functions are quite different by and large. And there are some quartets these days that actually rotate, as you know, like the Emerson Quartet and the St. Lawrence Quartet, and they do so very successfully. And they're obviously quite comfortable with it. Somehow in the Tokyo Quartet, it's always been fairly clearly defined, and I suppose by the mere fact that Kikue has been in the group now over 35 years, that he really feels comfortable in that role and is very, very proud to be the second violinist. So I don't think it's ever really occurred to him at least I'm speculating because I wasn't around, but I don't think it really ever occurred to him to move over, to make the lateral move, as it were.
Well, as you say, the roles are different, and I imagine it might be somewhat similar to, say, if in a French horn section of an orchestra, if the principal horn player leaves, the second horn player doesn't necessarily decide, hey, I think I'd like to be the first. He might say, I like sitting where I am. I like this, the range that the horn plays, and in this case, maybe you have to be a little more flamboyant leader type person to take on a first violin role.
Yeah, I think it. I think it all comes down to maybe first violinists are, as you point out, a little bit more towards exhibitionism rather than the second violin. The second violinist has to perform the roles very often of both a violinist and a violist. I mean, you're really the link between the first violin and the lower strings in the quartet.
Well, folks can have a look now that he's used the term flamboyant and see just how Martin Beaver manages with the Tokyo String Quartet. I mean, he's been at it for 9 years now, so it won't be new unless you've never seen them before, but you maybe hadn't heard this conversation before. They're performing at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts tomorrow night at 7:30, Tokyo String Quartet and pianist Alon Goldstein. And I thought we'd go out with actually a bit of a piece that is not on your program, but it is in one of the most recent recordings by the Tokyo Quartet, of which you are, and you're on this recording, of course. You have completed all of the Beethoven quartets. This is the second traversal for the Tokyo to do that. And I'm always amused, frankly, by this particular movement from a really sometimes bizarre quartet of Beethoven's, his C-sharp minor, which is one of his very last, is Opus 131. This is the fifth movement, Presto. And it sounds like this might be kind of tricky to put together.
Yes, indeed. It's the entire piece is like an odyssey for us as quartet players, partly for the reason that it's just composed from one movement to the next practically without any kind of pause. So it requires a lot of stamina and a lot of concentration while you're playing. This particular movement is surprisingly, well, I don't know if I should say surprisingly, but it's very witty in terms of Beethoven's writing, and he passes things back and forth. There's a lot of, passing of melodic figures from one instrument to the other, and it's very, very tricky to maintain. So it's always been a challenge.
And it is a lot of fun to listen to, certainly. And
well, there's a little fun in playing it too as well.
Well, and you can tell in your performance here. And it's been fun to talk to you. It's Martin Beaver of the Tokyo String Quartet. They'll be at the Krannert Center tomorrow night. Thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and that's happening at the Doudna Fine Arts Center at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston tonight. So something for you to go out and do that should be out of the ordinary. You're listening to Live and Local. Thank you. You just heard Ensemble Galilei from a disc called From the Edge of the World, and that was a medley of tunes, Caledonia Mudpike, some Scottish brawls, Squall Over Lachlan, Trip to Mull River, and The High Reel. And Ensemble Galilei is going to be participating along with NPR's Neil Conan and Lily Knight, and a lot of pictures in a project called First Person Seeing America at the Dowden Fine Arts Center at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston this evening. And here with me on Live and Local today is one of the two remaining founding members of Ensemble Galilei, Catherine Anderson Surick.
Carolyn.
I was going to do this without looking, but here's also Catherine Montoya, so maybe I did look and I saw the two together. Sorry about that, Carolyn. And then Neil Conan is here with us as well.
Hi, Kevin. Nice to see you.
I won't call you Don Gagne because I made the mistake of saying, hey, weren't you here just at WILL? And it turns out it was Don Gagne, and I mixed you guys up, and sorry about that, too. So who instigated this event, this project? I mean, this is not the first of your first person projects that you've done together.
Well, and it's not the first of our multimedia projects. We started with a show called Universe of Dreams, using pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope and poetry, and that was Neil and Ensemble Galilei. And then we decided to sort of do something else and
a little more ambitious. What we really wanted to do was to make all of it greater than the sum of its parts. We'd worked with text and music before in various contexts as we did these pictures with the Hubble Space Telescope, but we thought we could make a program that would be, well, just sweep people away. And that's what we wanted to do with first-person stories from the edge of the world, the music that you've been playing there. And then we wanted to take it to a new level because really the narrative structure of that first show I found very... It was a step forward, but in retrospect, limiting. And I think we've taken a step forward with that from that in our new show, which arranges it and structures it in a completely different and I think much freer, more open and much more spectacular way. And I think if people come and see it, they're going to leave not with something brand new in their heads.
Well, and also when we started creating First Person Seeing America, you know, we were working on it when the economy was tanking and we're at war, and it seemed to us as if we had these incredible images from the Metropolitan, and you know, Walker Evans has amazing photographs from the Great Depression, and we thought, well, let's take the strengths of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's photographic collection, and let's look at the things in America which are speak to us deeply and also are really important right now.
Resonate from those days to today, not just the Depression, which sadly resonates, but that muscular World War II, post-World War II America, of which there is so much still alive today, too, and we have to remember that as well. And the other parts is, of course, our history, the Civil War.
And then there's also Edward Curtis, who the Metropolitan has the entire collection of Edward Curtis, who went around at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century taking photographs of Native Americans. Those stunning black and white photographs from the West are by Edward Curtis, and they're fabulous.
So let's give our listeners a little better concept of what it is, it being this project. What is it that they will see?
Well, physically what you'll see is to the right side of your, as you're looking to the stage, you'll see the group, six musicians. They're pretty fabulous musicians. Carolyn can't say that, but I can. To the left of the stage, Lily Knight, the actress you mentioned, and myself, who are the narrators and performers, vocal performers. Behind us in this unbelievable hall at Eastern Illinois University is this fantastic screen on which will be projected these high-resolution images of these photographs. And they mesh. The one plays off the other. They flow seamlessly into each other, and it builds a montage is not the right word, a sequence of images and text and music that together present this image of an America that we all know. Because even though you don't think so, we say Walker Evans photographs, you've seen these photographs. They are your image of the American Depression. When you see them, you'll say, of course, I've seen those, the Edward Curtis photographs that we mentioned. There are Helen Levitt photographs of New York City urchins that will remind you so much, because they are so influential, of how we see that part of America and that place in history. And all of this flows together with these wonderful passages of text that we've chosen and the great music of Ensemble Galilei. And you'll come out with a different vision of America.
And is your goal to represent all of America somehow, or all of America at a certain period of time, or as much as you could squeeze in the space of 2 hours?
No, actually, our goal was to make art. I mean, to take these incredible pictures from the Met and find the very best way and the most powerful way to present them with music and text.
You should be there during the process, which is, I think is the most interesting part of the process. As much as I enjoy performing it on stage, putting it together, because what we all do is bring, we first got permission from the Met to use these images, and then we say, what pieces of text are going to be able to go with these images? And everybody in the group brought different elements to this process and say, wait a minute, we really should, you know, I've looked at these images and this piece will really work, and then we would try it out.
Well, and also, everyone in the group, musicians, all of the principals, have to read every page, every word of every page. And unless all of the people involved love that piece of writing, that poem or that piece of text, it doesn't get in. I mean, and there were some pieces that people brought that they thought, this is perfect, and they didn't make it. And so then, so we narrow down, we start with 500 pages of text, and we narrow it down to 10 pieces that we're going to use. And then Neil sits there.
And we read, and the musicians say, wait a minute, I know something that's going to be perfect with that. And Sue will start with something on the harp, and then we get the percussion joining in, or the banjo, and two fiddles, and then somebody, no. Mm-hmm. And then Carolyn will say, what about this? And then we'll find the exact piece of music, and you know it's the exact piece of music, because all of a sudden the hairs will go up on the back of your neck and you'll get goosebumps. And that's really the test. And that's when we know it's in the show.
So give us some examples of some of the texts that are in the show.
Well, Lily does some amazing things. There's a passage from James Agee, Knoxville, 1914. It's part of the introduction to that wonderful piece. And it is an image of an America that is about to change. And one of the things you realize is all of these parts of America, they are parts of America that is in constant change, which of course is the text of our national experience, constant change. But this is an image of an America just before its entry into the First World War. It is an image of a family that is about to be disrupted in all sorts of ways, which if you're familiar with the work, you know pretty well. But it's this wonderful image, Lily reading, of this family gathered on blankets outside on a warm summer's night, gathered in their wonderful connectedness, all of them together, all of them different, but all of them feeling each other in ways that is just this image of an America that no longer exists, but does exist in our memories. It does exist in the reverberations through history that you can see as she's reading the fireflies and the stars. It is just amazing.
And then there's a section of the show that starts with Frederick Douglass. Well, actually, it starts with Dexter Filkins, New York Times correspondent, war correspondent, and he's talking about soldiers in Iraq.
Now he writes for The New Yorker. But
yeah, right. And then so it goes from this wonderful piece by Dexter into Frederick Douglass.
Into Frederick Douglass's telling the story of how he escaped to freedom from Baltimore. To New York, and then eventually up into New England before he became Frederick Douglass. And the most powerful part of it, I think, yes, there's this escape from his masters, but he describes how his true liberation was, in fact, learning to read, and that this opened the world to him, and he realized the poverty of his condition, the intellectual poverty, the artistic poverty, and that's what he needed to escape from, as well as the subjugation to which he was, the lack of dignity and everything else. But there is a great moment in it in which he says, what shall be my name after all of this? I have a name that my mother gave to me, but I had dropped that by the time I left Baltimore. And we were sitting around at the breakfast table deciding, what shall I be called from now on? And the idea that this is one of the great figures of American history, in some ways, Abraham Lincoln's confessor just before and during the Civil War, that this is a man who would then say, what is my name? And realize that these are, up until that moment, Africans, slaves. And at that moment, he becomes an African-American, the first African generation of African-Americans. And the world changes again.
Well, and then it's followed by this a poem by Lucille Clifton about visiting a slave graveyard in the South, in which she says that she sees these tools, but there are no names, and that the graveyard lists 10 names, but they're all men. And she says, you know, tell me your names, my mothers, sisters, tell me your dishonored names, and I will testify. It's like, whoa. So you go from from Frederick Douglass saying needing a name to Lucille Clifton saying, who are, what are your names?
You anonymous workers.
Right. And
slaves.
And then it goes from there into the Gettysburg Address, which is read by, or is done by Lily in a way that makes you think you've never heard it before. I mean, it's quite an astonishing read.
And that's only the first half.
Yeah, actually, it's just the last 25 minutes of the first half. So, yeah, we're kind of in love with this show.
Well, I should hope so, and it sounds fascinating. Already, first person seeing America with Anselmo Galilei and Neil Conan and Lily Knight, and starring photographed from the Metropolitan Museum of Art at the Downtown Fine Arts Center tonight. The recording from which we're sampling came out from a previous project,
right,
also called First Person, from Letters from the Edge of the World with Anselmo Galilei. And so I thought we'd hear something else from here. This is music from Sweden.
Yes. Yes, and we actually have some Swedish music in the show tonight. Those great photographs that Neil was talking about by Helen Lovett of these joyous kids' pictures, we use Swedish music for, and it's quite it's fun. It's very
and
fun.
So this will give a little idea of what
yes.
that might be like.
Mm-hmm.
It's Anselmo Galilei here on Live and Local. Thank you. going to try to pronounce that somewhat. Vals från Jämtland, Jämtland Expressen Eklund Opolska, some sort of Polish dance, via Sweden in a performance here by the Ensemble Galilei, who are the musical ensemble involved in First Person Seeing America, along with NPR's Neil Conan and Lily Knight, giving readings from the words of Langston Hughes, Carson McCullers, Damon Runyon, John Muir, Frederick Douglass, as we've heard, and others. You're looking at me like maybe one of those isn't in there. I'm just reading your publicity material.
That was very old publicity material.
Yes. Damon Runyon didn't make it. But.
Yeah. He didn't make it. Well,
and
so
Carson
this
McCullers
was,
didn't either.
This was during. This was written during the concept
phase. Yes, that was actually pre-production.
So these are those were among the people that didn't get the okay from all the musicians.
It's true, you know. That's you know, the only person who's made it into every show that we have with words and music is Jim Harrison.
Absolutely.
And I don't know who Jim Harrison is.
A wonderful poet and After the Fall and great Western writer.
Legends of the Fall.
Legends of the Fall, yes.
Yeah, he's a wonderful, wonderful. And he writes prose, too.
Yeah, yeah, if we're talking language, we got to...
Yeah, yeah.
Be sure we have it. And, of course, a lot of photographs from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I mean, when you said that even though we may not know the names of some of these photographers, we'll know the photographs.
They
made
are
me
iconic,
now wonder which ones are we talking about here. I mean, you know, Ansel Adams is one who we represented, and I can picture some of his specifically by name, but some of the other folks... Not so much.
There is a picture that we use, for example, of a farmer in Kentucky, I think, who is sitting with his bare feet and his daughter next to him. And your image of the American Depression and what it looks like is in part that picture. When you see it, you will recognize it. You've seen it before.
Yeah.
And it'll give you almost immediately that the emotional quality that one has. I mean, I'm just looking at the picture that is, again, on this same publicity brochure of some guy who really looks depressed.
I think that may be the picture I'm talking about.
That is the tenant farmer picture, yes.
Well, there's no, in this case, it's just the head of the guy.
It's a close-up.
In his overalls. But So his daughter is next to him in the part we don't see.
There's a couple of different pictures, one of which is he's by himself, and the other you pull back and you see his daughter next to him.
And there's a great picture of a woman standing in front of a gas station where there are all of these tires, and it's got to be a 1932 picture or something.
I thought it was a little later than that.
Maybe a little later, but yeah. I mean, they're just these iconic American photographs.
So in a way, it sounds like this is sort of like Ken Burns Live.
Well,
similar concept in that you have
it is
profound
not a
words
dissimilar and... concept, but it is Ken Burns is very he's trying to tell very much a narrative story, and I think that would be that's not what we're trying to do. As Carolyn said, we're reaching. For art, not that Ken Burns does not achieve that. Certainly, I thought parts of the Civil War were, but we're not trying to tell a history. We're not trying to tell baseball in 9 chapters. We're trying to tell a story of America, not in snapshots, not in a montage, as I was saying, but in this seamless presentation of different aspects of the country and different voices and different musics and all of these wonderful images, so that it is assembled in a very different way than Ken Burns would do.
So you don't try to go chronologically
No.
From east to west in America or anything like that?
No. It's not a train trip across the country.
Well, as Carolyn said earlier, it's art, and you can create art in any sequence you want.
Well, mm-hmm. And also I think one of the things that you can't sort of discount is how powerful it is to see live people performing this stuff. Aside from the fact that the performance is different every night in its own way, when you have some of the musicians on stage are just the very best musicians in their fields. I mean, Hanneke Castle is one of the most incredible Scottish fiddlers in the country. Catherine Montoya is a really unparalleled early music wind player, but also plays whistles. And Sue Richards won the U.S. National Harp Championship 4 times. I mean, Jackie Moran has played with every major Irish band and been in many, many movies and on television.
Carolyn's not too bad either.
Well, so we have...
On bass viol.
On bass viol. You have these musicians who are really at the top of their game. And Neil, who of course is truly at the top of his game, Lily is an astonishing character actress.
Wait till you see her do Calamity Jane.
Oh, yeah. I mean, watching Lily do Calamity is incredible. I mean, she just becomes Calamity Jane.
And she does Abraham Lincoln.
And she does Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Yes. She is. I have learned so much. I got to teach her how to work a microphone up close because it's kind of what I do for a living, because that's as an actress. She doesn't do that. But she has taught me so much about approaching a character on stage. And I'd read poetry before and I'd been other characters before, but this really, I've got so much left to learn.
So everybody's stretching a bit in this project.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you all stretch together. I mean, I'm really feeling compelled to go see this, and I hope that others listening will be as well. It's called First Person Seeing America at the Dowden Fine Arts Center on the campus of Eastern Illinois University in Charleston tonight. And I'm actually missing the starting time. Dan Cruz is with us. Is it 7:30?
7:30.
7:30 p.m. For more information, I wrote it on this piece of paper. You can go to eiu.edu/Doudna, D-O-U-D-N-A, for more information on Ensemble Galilei. You can go to egmusic.com. And if you want to know all about Neil Conan, go to npr.org. And you have to navigate around, which I do occasionally, and find out about us. And then you can find out about people. And that's always
Or you could just click on Talk of the Nation.
or you could do that, too. Mm-hmm. Lots of ways to do it. And thank you all. Thank you both very much for coming up here. And,
thanks for the opportunity to talk about the show. And we hope to see you there.
And it was great. Great.
And we'll hear more from Ensemble Galilei in just a moment or two. Let me mention that our broadcast today comes in part with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We also have support from the Corkscrew, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday, Laura Keon of Campbell Fine Wines will be representing Montanore Estate of Oregon and Pass Parker Wines of California. Then, live music from 7 to 9 p.m. by the Brian Holloway Somethin' Trio. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translators, W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Here's Ensemble Galilei performing a composition of one of its own, the harp player Sue Richards. This is called Suki's Waltz.